This week on the Best of Flashpoints, we launch our multi-part series, Anatomy of a Financial Coup d'Etat, with Catherine Austin Fitz. Plus, Obama's war in Afghanistan continues to unravel. We'll speak with investigative journalist Gareth Porter. Protesters in San Francisco disrupt a speech given by former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert, attempting citizens' arrest for the massacres in occupied Palestine. And an attorney representing members of the Uyghur community detained inside the U.S. torture prison camp at Guantanamo talks about the Supreme Court finally agreeing to hear their case. All this straight ahead on this week's Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Please stay tuned. Coming up later on in this broadcast, we will start our series in the anatomy of a cover-up of the financial coup d'etat with Catherine Austin Fitz. We're going to take you to places that maybe you don't even want to go. But first, we turn our attention back to Afghanistan. I am Dennis Bernstein, and as I said, this is your daily investigative news magazine. At the end of last week, Interpress News Service reported that a veteran Army officer who served both in Afghanistan and Iraq is warning that the U.S. Is current counterinsurgency strategy that's being pushed by General Stanley McChrystal is actually likely to strengthen the Afghan insurgency. IPS reports that in a 63-page paper representing his personal views, but reflecting conversations with other officers, Lieutenant Colonel Daniel Davis argues that it is too late for U.S. forces to defeat the insurgency. And he says this addition, this expansion, this surge could only make things worse. Joining us to talk about this is Gareth Porter. He has been reporting on the situation around Lieutenant Colonel Davis and the situation surrounding Afghanistan. Porter is an investigative historian and journalist who specializes in national security issues. He is the author of Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power, and the Road to War. Gareth Porter, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thank you, Dennis. Glad to be on again.
Well, it's good to have you with us. Tell us about the background in terms of this colonel really contradicting McChrystal's assessments.
Well, I think what this is telling us is that there is a good deal of dissent in that middle section of the military where you have officers who have been in the field in command positions, in staff positions, have come back and have had a little bit of time to think about this and really are very well aware that what is being done and what is being planned for the future is not working. It's going to simply get the United States more deep into a war that cannot be won and which is going to result in more dead and dying, more suffering, and in the end, failure by the United States. And that's what is really behind this proposal, an analysis by Lieutenant Colonel Davis to really calling for the United States to withdraw the bulk of its combat forces from Afghanistan in an 18-month period. This is the first time I know of where there has been a long-experienced officer or civilian, for that matter, who's come out with that kind of concrete proposal. And he tells me, and I believe him, that it's based on conversations with a lot of other officers who've come back and really represents a great deal of unease with the current policy and a feeling that something has to change dramatically.
Now, has the colonel or any others, any of his colleagues, spoken with McChrystal, tried to inform him, give him, brief him on this alternative view?
You know, I don't know the answer to the broader question of whether any of the officers that he's spoken with have tried to persuade General McChrystal to move in a different direction. I rather doubt it, and I'll tell you why. I think what we're faced with here is the difference between an officer who is really who's had time to think, who, you know, this is Lieutenant Colonel Davis. He's come back from Iraq, where he was stationed as a commander of a transition unit near the Iraqi-Iranian border. He was medevaced back to the States. He had a problem with his vision, which prevented him from continuing in a command position. And so he had several months, really, to recover. And, you know, I think that it's clear that he's really made a fundamental decision, that he's putting more importance on telling the truth than he is his potential future as a colonel, a general in the U.S. Army. And I think that's a fundamental turning point in his career. I think that the people who he's talking with or has talked with in the military are either people who have decided that their future lies with sort of getting along within the military and they're not ready to speak out, or if they have decided to speak out, it's really after they've come back from Afghanistan. So essentially the ones who are in a position to talk to General McChrystal are not the ones who are willing to speak out publicly.
You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. We're talking with Garth Porter about a series of articles he's written for IPS. And we're talking now about Lieutenant Colonel Daniel L. Davis. He wrote a 63-page paper in which he says that current policy and the expansion with 40,000 more troops, he believes, is, I'm quoting now, is almost certain to further exacerbate the problems there. And I guess it's really important for somebody with this kind of knowledge to speak out. I was speaking with Ray McGovern, who's a former high-level CIA analyst, just before we came on the air, and he was incredibly concerned because there is no non-military, there's very little intelligence being gathered of substance that could be used to advise the president one way or another. So the military has a lot of power here.
Well, that's right, of course. I mean, all of the flow of information on what's going on in Afghanistan essentially is coming from the military itself. And that is a dangerous situation, particularly because the U.S. military in Afghanistan, perhaps uniquely, even more than any other war, and then let me tell you that Vietnam and Iraq are two cases of a U.S. military that did not have good intelligence by any means. But Afghanistan is leagues worse in terms of U.S. intelligence on what is happening in that society, on what the people in the villages of Afghanistan, particularly the Pashtun villages of Afghanistan, are thinking, what their aspirations are, what their grievances are. We really have a situation where the U.S. military went for 8 years without having any mechanism whatsoever to gather real intelligence on what is happening at the village level and what the people really feel. Now, that is beginning to change. This past 6 months to 9 months, I think you're beginning to get, trickling upward, if you will, a little bit of information about what the real situation is on the ground. And I think that that has had an impact on the report, the initial assessment by General McChrystal on the situation in Afghanistan, where he was remarkably candid in saying that, first of all, you know, there's a very large proportion of the population that is ready to tolerate, as he put it, the insurgency. That's a remarkable statement for a commanding general to make, carrying out a counterinsurgency war against this insurgency. And I think it's because, for the first time, the military has been getting a trickle of information upwards from the villages, telling him that these people are so upset, so angry at the abuses of civilian population by the police in particular and the security forces, security personnel in general of the Afghan government, that they are in fact ready to turn to the Taliban for protection from those miscreants, from those people who are carrying out, in many cases, violence against civilians.
Now, I imagine that the concerns are being raised now where you have the situation of a fraudulent election and maybe a U.S.-supported president who does not want to to pay attention to the massive fraud that brought him his reelection, and then put 40,000 more troops in the middle. I mean, what? I guess the lieutenant colonel has many concerns about what could go wrong if the policy goes the way McChrystal wants it.
Absolutely right. I mean, the election issue is very much at the center of the discussion in the White House. That's very clear. That's one thing that has been reiterated, I think, over and over again in recent weeks. And I have to tell you that I have one particular fear at this moment, and that is that what the Obama administration, what President Obama himself has really been doing these past few weeks, is putting pressure on President Karzai by holding off on any decision regarding the troop request as a way of pressuring him to accept a runoff in the belief that somehow that's going to mitigate the problem of legitimacy, which is clearly a very serious problem at this point in Afghan society and politics. I'm afraid that what we may be looking at here is that the president has really already decided to give some significant percentage, proportion of the request for troops to General McChrystal, but he's holding off in the belief that he can use this as a pressure on Karzai. If I'm correct, then if Karzai does in fact sort of fold up and accept the need for runoff, then we will quickly see a decision by the White House that will give to General McChrystal a large part of his request. And we can assume, I think very safely, that General McChrystal has padded his request hugely, so that if he gets half of what he has requested, it will be more or less what he wanted in the first place.
All right. Finally, before we let you go, it's sort of a little bit backwards, but how would you assess the current situation, particularly in the context of the flare-ups and the bold attacks taking place in Pakistan?
Certainly, there is a pushback by the Pakistani Taliban, the so-called neo-Taliban, against the Pakistani military's offensive, and they have certainly shown that they're a formidable force in terms of their ability to carry out terrorist actions in the heart of the Pakistani military's power. That is to say, the Punjab, which is the that part of India, that's that section of India where the Pakistani military gets most of its recruits, most of its officer corps comes from the Punjab. The Pakistani military is traditionally a Punjabi institution. And so this is really a way of symbolically saying we can strike into the heart of the Pakistani military's power. I would not, however, go along with some of the alarm that may have been expressed in recent days about the Pakistani nuclear capabilities, that somehow this attack, which is really, you know, meant that a bomber got through the first level of security of the headquarters of the Pakistani military. I don't think that's equivalent of being able to threaten to get a hold of a nuclear weapon. That's a much, much, much more difficult challenge for any Taliban outfit in Pakistan. I don't think that we're talking here about a threat to the Pakistani nuclear capabilities.
But the overall view is looks like war and more war, huh?
Yeah, I mean, this Pakistani civil war, if you will, is not one that's going to be wrapped up anytime soon. It's going to go on for a long time. And more and more, I'm suggesting here that you look for really sort of the revolutionary situation that is potentially there in throughout Pakistan, not just in the Waziristan and the tribal region of northwest Pakistan, but in the heartland of Pakistan, you have a situation which has long festered, where the upper class of Pakistan has held such huge social and political power and has had so little regard for the underclass that is going to be more and more a factor in the movement against the Pakistani military and government, which of course is the government itself is run by the representatives of that class. And so that is, I'm afraid, going to be part of the war that's going on in Pakistan, and it's going to make it more difficult to suppress the extremist Islamic movement in Pakistan, because it's going to take advantage of very deep-seated and real grievances against the government and against the upper class of Pakistan.
All right, that's the voice of Garth Porter. He has been doing some reporting on the situation in Afghanistan for IPS. He's an investigative historian and journalist who specializes in national security issues. And we thank you, sir, for being with us again on Flashpoints.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We continue our focus on the ongoing detention and imprisonment of people at Guantanamo Bay. As President Obama steadily builds and expands the Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan to house a state-of-the-art detention camp there, his administration says he remains, quote, committed to closing the torture prison camp at Guantanamo. However, over 220 detainees remain in draconian conditions at Guantanamo Bay as we speak. Today, the U.S. Supreme Court announced that it will hear the case of 13 men who are included in that prison population, despite being cleared for release since 2004. The 13 defendants are all Uyghurs from China, and the court is also addressing the issue of whether it can order the men released into the U.S. when there is no other alternative. Joining us to talk about the situation in Guantanamo and the significance of this hearing is Shaina Karidal. Karidal is the senior managing attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights in the Guantanamo Global Justice Initiative. He speaks to us from New York City. Shaina, thank you so much for being with us today on Flashpoints.
Well, thanks for having me.
So let's remind people who these 13 Uyghur men are and how they came to be detained and tortured at Guantanamo.
Sure. Well, I suppose first I should start by answering the question that their lead counsel asked of us when we assigned him the case years ago, which is, what's a Uyghur? The Uyghurs are a small ethnic minority of Muslims from the sort of old Silk Road kind of area of Western China, the sort of Wild West of China, as it were, the area kind of depicted in the movie Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. And they are about 7 million in number, and they consider themselves oppressed in the same way that Tibetans are, that the central government is moving Han Chinese into their area, and you know, giving them all the economic opportunities. And they're also treated the same way as Tibetans are when they leave the country. They're per se regarded as separatists, as terrorists, and liable to be executed if they are sent back to China. So these men had been sort of trying to work their way towards Turkey, basically, and were in Afghanistan when 9/11 happened, living sort of impoverished lives in this little village with other Uyghurs. They all sort of fled towards Pakistan, were taken in by villagers who they thought were trying to help them, and then were sold for bounties to Pakistani troops and then to the Americans, and then ended up in Guantanamo. So they were cleared years ago, but the U.S. also acknowledged at the time that it acknowledged that they shouldn't have been, you know, picked up in the first place. It also acknowledged they couldn't be sent back to China because of the risk of torture for any Uyghurs who were sent back there. So they're really stranded at Guantanamo. They have no place to be sent, and yet they've won their habeas cases. The judges have said, there is no legal basis for continuing to hold them. So the question here is really about the remedy. Can the court order them released into the United States if there's no other option?
What kinds of conditions are these 13 men in after spending years in this prison camp? And for that matter, what's going on behind the prison walls in general that your clients are reporting?
Well, you know, the Obama administration has made some progress on conditions at Guantanamo generally, but still more than half of the detainees are held in solitary confinement. And we know from a variety of sort of psychological studies over the years that keeping people in solitary confinement past about 90 days almost universally produces serious psychological problems. So that's the big picture. Now, the Uyghurs and most of the other people who've won their habeas cases have at least won the right to be moved to this very low security camp called Camp Iguana, but they're still behind two layers of chicken wire. And you know, the difference between them and the other men in the prison is that they have a view of the ocean in front of them, which, you know, in some ways I think is ironic that they you know, are reminded every day how close they are to freedom. And that really is just about all that you win when you win your habeas case. You know, out of 38 cases that have gone to hearings, 30 men have been ordered or have been found to be unlawfully held by the government. But out of those 30, there are roughly 18 still at Guantanamo, including these Uyghur men, because of the decision of the Court of Appeals in the Uyghur case, which said basically, you know, all you have the right to get in habeas is an order from the court asking the executive, the president, to take diplomatic efforts to try to release you from Guantanamo. And since the court can't order you released into the United States, that's the most a court can do. So that's really the issue that's before the Supreme Court. Was the Court of Appeals right in saying that? You know, and the reason so many people who've won their habeas cases are still stuck at Guantanamo is because the district court judges don't feel they have the power to do anything more. That's why this case going up to the Supreme Court is so important. If it were just about these 13 men, then I don't think they would have taken it.
That's the voice of Shana Kadidal. He's with the Center for Constitutional Rights in the Guantanamo Global Justice Initiative. And Shana, you know, talking more about the significance of this case today and the hearing, the announcement of the hearing in the Supreme Court, in the context of holding the Obama administration accountable for its role in continuing to operate Guantanamo, just as human rights advocates have tried to hold the Bush administration to the same account, what does the fight ahead to really close Guantanamo and deliver justice to the detainees who have been there, what does that look like right now?
Well, you know, I think this is an essential sort of part of the whole thing. You know, if you look at how the other cases have played out in the district courts right now, a lot of them are basically ready to be heard, but the litigation is grinding to a halt because Obama's task force has decided that an awful lot of these men should be released. And yet what they do is they turn around and they go to the court and say, well, look, you know, in light of the decision that's on appeal to the Supreme Court here, the most a court can do is just tell us that we should try to release the person and try to make our best efforts to do that, and we're already doing that. So you, the court, don't have to go forward with the case. And what's happened is that most of the courts have agreed and said, well, you know, until the Supreme Court changes things, we're just going to put a stay on this habeas case. And so the litigation is really just kind of, you know, ground to a halt. So that's definitely one of the many really important kind of you know, consequences of the decision that's on appeal here. But you know, beyond that, you know, this is really Obama's prison at this point. We are you know, almost 10 months into his administration, and they have released far fewer people than the Bush administration ever you know, released over a similar sort of time period. You know, I think really at bottom it's a failure of leadership. It's a failure of President Obama to come out and use his voice, which is the loudest voice in the political debate, to say, you know, look, there are plenty of people there who are innocent, who never should have been picked up in the first place, and that's why we're going to start letting them go. You know, he's tried to sort of, you know, push off responsibility for making the decisions to this big, huge panel of experts, which, like most panels of experts, has gone very slowly through the process, and at the same time, he's used that task force to kind of hold up the litigation, which means that, you know, the courts have not come in to sort of take the political pressure off him by ordering releases, and then when they have done that, you know, he hasn't wanted to enforce it. So it's really a big mess, and you know, I place a lot of the responsibility for it on the president's desk.
In Berkeley, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Last night, 22 activists were arrested at former Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert's speech to the World Affairs Council at the Westin St. Francis Hotel in downtown San Francisco. Over 250 people were protesting outside the hotel as dozens of activists launched an organized campaign of disruption inside the auditorium, including attempting to place Olmert under citizen's arrest. Every couple of minutes, more activists disrupted his speech, barely allowing him to speak, by reading the names of the children killed in Gaza last winter, or reading from the recently published Goldstone report and displaying banners that read, "Lift the siege on Gaza," and "War crimes are not free expression." Activists were removed from the auditorium chanting "war criminal" and taken to the Tenderloin police station, where they were held for citation and released. Olmert ordered Israel's brutal attacks on Gaza beginning in late December 2008, codenamed Operation Cast Lead. Last week, the United Nations Human Rights Council passed a resolution endorsing the Goldstone Report, an independent investigation into the Gaza operation which killed 1,400 Palestinians and found that Israel violated international law and possibly committed crimes against humanity. Flashpoints was on the street during the demonstration. Here are some of the voices from last night's protest.
Long live Palestine! Long live Palestine! Long live Palestine! Long live Palestine!
Tell us your first name and why you're here today and how old you are.
My name's Hussam, and I'm here because there's a war criminal speaking right across the street from us today. His name is Ehud Olmert, and instead of being up on stage and getting paid some kind of salary for going around speaking, he should actually be in prison or answering to some type of international court of justice for the war crimes that he committed against my city, Gaza, in the winter time, where basically bombing the population and starving them, making sure that the situation is not livable for any Palestinian living there. So, I mean, that's why I'm here.
And I know you're not inside, but if you could be inside, what question would you ask Olmert?
Oh, I wouldn't be asking him a question. I'd just be yelling at him. And I hope other people are in there yelling at him right now.
What would you yell?
Huh?
What would you yell?
Send this guy to prison.
Thank you, Hussam. Okay, tell us your first name and why you're here and what your sign says.
Rob. My sign says, "Jews condemn Israeli war crimes." And I'm here because I believe that Ehud Olmert, the ex-prime minister of Israel, is a war criminal. He launched a campaign last winter that killed over 1,500 Palestinians, many of them civilians, many of them children. And we think it was wrong for him to do that, to say it in a mild way. And I would like to see him put before the International Court of Justice and prosecuted for crimes against humanity and war crimes.
My name is Lara Kiswani. I'm 28. I'm here to let everyone, including everyone that's attending this event, know that it's not okay that he's here, that we don't support this, and that we will make it an issue, and if we have to, we'll disrupt it.
And how can we disrupt it?
Inside and out, by giving him hell and making it more complicated.
I'm a citizen of West Jerusalem, and I remember when Olmert was the mayor of West Jerusalem, and the hatred that he had for us, if you want to call us Arab Israelis or Israeli Arabs, but we are Palestinians. And he had this cynical body language towards us. And he was the person that was really behind the Judaization of East Jerusalem.
Yeah, my name is Nabil Wahbe, and the reason I'm here today is to protest against the ex-prime minister of Israel who's speaking here. He's coming here to talk about Israel, and he's the one who organized the war against Gaza, where lots of civilians and children died. And he comes here and they don't care how many children or women they kill, old people they die, they destroyed Gaza. So I'm here to protest, to tell people, go help Gaza, help the Palestinian. All what we want is justice. That's all what we want.
And what does your sign say?
Let Gaza live. and Free Palestine support the right of return.
My name is Josh Healy. Right now I'm holding the sign that has two young Palestinian boys, names on the front and the back. Boy named Abdul, age 14, and Asma, age 12, who were both killed in Gaza by Omer and the Israeli army earlier this year.
And what significance does it have for you as a Jew to be holding this sign and here on this side of the literal fence with the Palestinian community in solidarity? Talk about what that means right now.
These names are not just names. These names are people. These names are brothers. These names are sisters. These could be my brothers and could be my sisters, and in the past were my brothers and sisters. And now it's people who say they're my brothers and sisters killing and holding the guns and holding the tanks and speaking in San Francisco at this schmancy hotel, talking to who knows who about God knows what. And they should not have a welcome response. They should not have people cheering them. They should have, Omer should be at the international court being tried for war crimes because of over 1,000 Palestinians that he's personally responsible for their deaths. As a Jewish American, as a Jew, as an American, I'm doubly obligated to speak out. And I feel it in my heart, and I feel it in the streets, and I feel it because there's people across the street waving Israeli and American flags, and I don't think they know what those flags really mean. And I don't think they know what's really being done in their names, because if they did, I don't think they would be on that side of the street. So my job is to be with my people, and my people is whoever stands for justice, even if my people don't always stand with me.
My name is Ziad Dabbas. I'm a Palestinian. I came here tonight because I couldn't stay far the moment I heard that Olmert coming here and that the people, they welcome someone should be arrested for war crimes, and I came here to raise my voice to say he should be arrested and he should send to the international court.
And what are your thoughts on the fact that he was invited to come? He's been on this national speaking tour. He's being paid a lot of money. People are coming to see him to pay money. What do you think about the climate right now, the social climate that would invite a war criminal and pay him lots of money?
Absolutely. If you go back to the history, we saw many people, they were invited here to this country and they were wanted for international courts. At the same time here, they are wanted for the international courts. The people that invited them, they are wanted for what happened in Iraq, for what's going on right now in Afghanistan. So it's connected to each other. It's the oppressors coming together. At the same time, it's like people, they need to take such kind of a stand where they should not accept that that the United States of America support Israel, not just by money, not just in the United Nations, not just by weapons and all this kind of stuff, even politically in a strong way, like welcoming someone like this, marketing him to the people as someone coming to speak about peace or anything like this, it means that they are participating with him. They are together, and the American people should raise their voices to say no, to welcome someone. Soon or later, he will be arrested for war crimes.
And finally, what do you think of all the young people who came out tonight? What do you think of the way that they were protesting?
Absolutely, there are some people, they couldn't accept this happened in San Francisco, and they came out, most of them young generation, and they are amazing. They had a lot of energy and they raised their voices, but still American people, Arabs, anyone struggle for justice should be here to raise the voices. It was good, but still we are looking for more people to participate in this kind of events and raise their voices. This is the place where people should come to struggle for justice.
Okay, Nancy Hormashay, you're an immigration lawyer. Tell us what's going on here, where we are.
We're standing on the side door of the hotel, and we had been watching people being brought out in handcuffs. We were able to get about the names of about 8 to 10 people Approximately, we saw two men and the rest were women. There were some men who were put in the van earlier. We saw three vans taken away, and then they stopped us from taking names. So we don't know the names of all the people that have been arrested, but we're estimating between 10 and 20 people.
And have the police said anything about why they're arresting these activists?
They won't talk to us. They say it's a security matter. They won't talk to us.
You know, what's interesting to me, and I was trying to talk to these cops over on the corner, is that, you know, here's a wanted war criminal, a terrorist, who has the blood of at least 1,400 people on his hands, and yet he's being protected by the police. Can we make a citizen's arrest?
If we see him, I suppose. Interesting question, Nora. I think that the police would probably prevent us from getting close to Mr. Olmert.
Anything else you can say about what's going on here?
No, there's just a high level of security. They've put up these barricades to keep us back, saying it's a security issue. The people that were arrested were very, very peaceful. They were taken in handcuffs and pushed into the vans, and their personal belongings were left inside, purses and things like that, so they don't have any of their things with them.
And how many cops are here? It's a whole swarm of them.
Yeah, there's at least 25 I can see right here, and then there's probably at least that many around the corner. And then a group of them have already left with the people that were arrested.
Lisa Nessen, a Bay Area activist, was inside the auditorium. Here's what she had to say after several others were arrested and put into paddy wagons by the San Francisco Police Department.
So about 22 people were inside and disrupted the presentation.
How?
People were shouting, you know, war criminal, you have blood on your hands. People in Gaza are dying and without water and without schools and sanitation because of war crimes that you committed during your presidency.
Even though cameras and recording equipment were not allowed inside the auditorium, activists were able to sneak some documentation of the disruption of Olmert's speech. Here is some of that footage.
The arrest of Ehud Olmert for high crimes against the Palestinian people, especially in the Gaza Strip and the people of Lebanon.
He's a war criminal.
I'm a Palestinian. My family are in Gaza. This number of people and double the number of this join my voice by saying you are a war criminal. You've killed children. You've killed families. You killed people. You deny them their life. Aren't you ashamed of yourself?
Sir, San Francisco.
Shame of San Francisco to have a war criminal here. Shame on us. Shame on San Francisco.
Shame on you, war criminal. White phosphorus weapons and dime explosives used against innocent people in residential areas, hospitals destroyed.
I'm sorry, but I'm tired of seeing. It's very distracting to see the blood on your hands.
You can view the entire video at electronicintifada.net. Olmert is continuing his national tour. He was in Chicago last week, where he was disrupted. And he's continuing on to Arkansas this week. Reporting from the streets of San Francisco, this is Nora Barrows-Friedman for Flashpoints.
You are listening to Flashpoints. This is your daily investigative news magazine. And today we begin a multi-part series. We're calling it The Anatomy of a Financial Coup d'Etat. The series is a part of an extended version of Community Business with Catherine Austin Fitz. Over the next several days, Catherine, a former assistant housing secretary, Wall Street banker, will take us through the steps that led up to the recent financial meltdown and bailout. And today we're going to begin with an overview of the systems that were created, such as NAFTA and WTO, to facilitate the coup d'etat and really to facilitate the movement of money, ways and structures to centralize and move money. Catherine Austin Fitz, it is good to have you back. We have done this once before with our Anatomy of a Cover-Up with Enron. I urge people to get your pencils and your pens out. And maybe if there's a quick typist out there, we can type these things up. And who knows, maybe it'll be a book someday. Catherine, good to have you with us. I appreciate that you are willing to go the whole way with us and help people understand exactly what happened to them in the hope that it'll help them fight back in a more effective way that brings power back to the community.
Well, we're gonna start tonight with a, you know, some people call it the global chessboard. I'm thinking of it as a global checkerboard, you know, so there's a global game. And in any game, there's a goal of the game, Dennis. And the goal of the game has been who controls and who owns the equity. And by the equity, I mean the ownership of something. Okay? And that's really been the game. And so, you know, we'll bring this back down to the community level, but where it's what it's going to come down to is how can we reaffirm our ownership and control of the resources in our community networked with other communities. So, you know, we need to be a global network too. So let's begin in the 90s, because two things happened in the 90s that set the stage for a dramatic shift in money that we've been experiencing. And one was the passage of the Uruguay Round for GATT, the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs. And with that, in at the end of 1994 or 95, the creation of the World Trade Organization. And what that did, Dennis, was it changed the rules. It changed the rules by which resources could be allocated and managed globally. And then in support of that, one of the things that made it possible was the institution of global satellite systems and surveillance and enforcement systems that would, as we shifted the money out of the first world, would allow you know, the people who controlled investment capital to basically enforce their wishes and make sure that the terms and conditions of that capital would prevail. And so with the change of the rule and a shifting and building out of the enforcement infrastructure, we saw the platform created by which huge amounts of money could be moved out of the United States. And you've heard me tell the story before of the head of the pension fund of CalPERS, the largest pension fund in the country and the big California pension fund, saying to me in 1997, "You don't understand, they've given up on the United States. It's too late. They're moving all the money out of the country starting in the fall." Now, when he said they're moving all the money, what does that mean? Well, it means two things. We're moving industry, so manufacturing and jobs, and we're moving capital. So, for example, let me give you a little example. So let's say we decide we're going to take a factory that's outside of, you know, the Bay Area in San Francisco, and we're going to move that work to China. And to make that move, we're going to take capital from the California pension funds and finance the creation of a new plant and infrastructure in China. Okay, so what's interesting is you're basically taking the capital of the workers here and using it to finance the infrastructure abroad that shifts their jobs to that place, but in a way where once that shift has happened, a very different set of group of people own the equity. Okay?
Okay.
So we're basically, you know, we're basing shifting equity out of a large group of people's hands into a much more concentrated group of hands. Now, we knew in the early 1990s, and as I've described in my many writings and stories, we knew that that process was going to happen with the creation of GATT and then a similar agreement on North America, NAFTA. And so there were many of us, Dennis, in Washington working to come up with plans that would help the middle class and Americans retool their skills and do a series of things that would allow them to create new equity and to preserve the equity they had. And so this was all sort of known, and it was known how important it was to build new equity in this country. Now, that's not what happened. What happened was a decision was made that insisted on keeping people, lulling people into a kind of You know, it's almost like a false, a mythic reality where we created a lot of capital liquidity with lots of different mechanisms, which I'm going to talk about, one of which was debt and the housing bubble. So we bubbled the economy. And as we bubbled the economy, we did it in a way that created lots of jobs, but not jobs that were sustainable in a real economy. You know, jobs that at some point as the bubble burst would go away and leave people much more dependent on government and with much less, back to this old world, equity. They would own much less in the value of their house and their businesses when it was all said and done. And so it's let's just step through the different mechanisms that you and I have covered on community business, but it helps to kind of see them all together. The first thing we did was we issued tremendous amounts of debt, both for state, local, and federal government, and a lot of consumer debt, mortgage debt, auto debt, credit card debt. You know, we've been through all these different forms of debt. And that debt created bubbles and lots of economic activity, but in the process, our value, our financial security was getting drained out. Now, what's interesting is, as you know, as the head of CalPERS said to me, they're giving up on the country. They're moving all the money out in the fall. Unfortunately, it was our pension funds that then bought a lot of debt that, in fact, it was pretty easy at that point to know we couldn't afford to pay back. So not only were we issuing mortgages and originating mortgages to people when we knew they were going to lose their jobs and their incomes were going to fall, but we were then turning around and selling that paper to their pension funds. So, you know, it was kind of a double whammy. We also did the pumps and dumps in the stock market that you and I covered in our stories of Enron.
Say a little bit about a pump and dump.
So let's take the internet pump and dumps, because they're, you know, you're in San Francisco in the Bay Area, and they hit the Bay Area so hard. So I'll give you an example. In 1997, I was at Esther Dyson's it was 96 or 97. I was at Esther Dyson's conference for her newsletter on, you know, technology companies. And it was amazing because there were venture capitalists there who were literally finding entrepreneurs who had an idea. It wasn't even yet a company. And let's say that company, you know, to start a software company that would make a tool to help people find lower priced commodities on the internet, something like that. Let's say they really needed about $500,000 to get that company going. These venture capitalists would insist that they take $10 million. And I was literally watching one after another venture capitalist promise, you know, $5, $10, $15, $20 million to companies I knew as an investment banker. Those companies would never add any value in the real marketplace, would never make it. Well, why was that happening? What was happening is if you create, let's say we create 500 companies, we put $10 million in, we get them going, we package them up, and then we turn around and sell them. We do IPOs into the stock market, and every time we put in 10, we get out $50 million. Okay, so we get a huge amount of our capital back out, and we stick the pension funds and retail investors with basically pigs and poke, and then they crash. Well, we've pumped the internet market, and we've sucked out a huge amount of money, and now that money is free to move out into the emerging markets. Okay, it's a kind of sort of systemic financial fraud. We saw it with Enron. We saw it with the telecom stocks. We saw it with the internet, but a huge amount of money got pulled out of that. Another way was the missing money. $4 trillion went missing between fiscal 1998 and 2002 from the federal government. We've never gotten accounting of where it went to this day. The federal government does not comply with the laws requiring audited financial statements. $4 trillion went missing. You know, where did it go? We don't know.
How do we know $4 trillion went missing?
$4 trillion went missing because there were laws passed, and I was instrumental in helping get them passed, requiring federal agencies to produce audited financial statements. And in 1995, they started reporting through the General Accounting Office to say that they couldn't, and in the process of saying why they couldn't, they would report their undocumentable adjustments. And that's the adjustments they wrote to their books to force them to balance when they wouldn't. And so during the period in the official audit reports from the General Accounting Office for HUD and Pentagon, and there could be many more, there are rumored to be many more, but I've just never gone through them and researched, but from the Pentagon and HUD and NASA that we know, in their documents, there's $4 trillion. If you go to Solari, if you do a search for missing money plus Solari.com, you'll pick up our missing money page, where for years we just kept links to all the documentation that documented all of this. And so literally $4 trillion, and that works out to about $15,000 per American. So if you've got a family of four, you're talking about $60,000. So huge, huge amounts of money, no less than that, huge, huge amounts of money being pulled out, and we don't know where it went, okay? Another one, of course, is securities fraud, and I believe that was what financed a fair amount of the missing money. But as you know, Dennis, as I was Assistant Secretary of Housing and then financial advisor to FHA, or my company was, and a lot of my writings have documented why I believe that there was significant mortgage fraud in the securities area. Now, let me say what I mean by this. If you look at the subprime mortgage portfolios that were said to have 50% losses, well, you can't have 50% losses from just overvaluing. Let's say a home is worth $100,000, but you value it as $150,000 on the mortgage. You can't get to $50,000 losses that fast. What you have to do is what I believe happened, which is you issue 10 mortgages on the same house, and you put them in a mortgage-backed security, and that is literally a fraud. We've seen, you and I talked last week about this strategy a lot of people are using, requiring lenders before they foreclose to produce the note, and many of them can't produce the note. And I believe one of the reasons they can't produce that note is given fraudulent mortgage issuance. You know, I think there's just real confusion as to who really has the real note on the property.
You listen. Let me just jump in. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's the voice of Catherine Austin Fitz. Usually you hear her on Wednesdays on Flashpoints. Our regular segment is Community Business, but Catherine and I have decided that we wanted to take a closer look at what we're calling the anatomy of a financial coup d'etat, a closer look at what happened since the 90s and what led up to this meltdown and this bailout, and really what is the significance of what happened and how to rescue back the resources ultimately of your own community. It's a very important thing for people to understand what happened and where it looks like we're going right now. So again, Catherine, I say that. And let me also say, in listening to you, I certainly want people to understand what's going on. So what we're going to do, which we didn't plan, but I'm sure you won't mind, Catherine, is I'm going to leave 10 minutes at the end of this show, 8 to 10 minutes, for people to call and ask questions. So I'm telling you that now so that you can think about your questions, have a precise, focused question, and we'll see if we can answer questions. And those questions will tell us also, Catherine, what we need to talk more about and if we've got a good beginning here, because we're going to go through this over the next several days and weeks, and we want people to be able to follow along. And if they have questions, we want them to ask. So the phone number here is 510-848-4425. We're not going to take questions for another 5 to 10 minutes, but I give you the number, 510-848-445. Is that it? 510-848-4425? Yes? Great. All right. Let's continue.
Okay, so the last thing we did to create this kind of bubble was derivatives trading. And derivatives just created, one, much more leverage in the system, but they also allowed...
What's a derivative?
A derivative, Dennis, a derivative is a financial interest, which has value derived from another thing. So, for example, a stock or a bond is an investment in something that's real. I buy an equity security in a corporation that owns cows, okay? So I have a financial asset, but it's an interest in something that's real. A derivative is a financial investment in a financial asset. So if I have an option on that stock, I have an interest in something that's still a financial asset. So it's a financial asset that's an interest in a financial asset, and its value is derived from that financial asset. Okay, and these get very abstract. So let me give you an example. A lot of the mortgage securities were packaged into something called CDOs, and then the somebody was asked to guarantee those securities, and that was considered to be a derivative. Okay, and so we have AIG who's guaranteeing the principal of a package of mortgages that are basically don't have financial integrity that Goldman Sachs issues. So in the bailouts that we saw when AIG got bailed out and the money boomed $10 billion right back to Goldman Sachs to bail them out of all these sort of crummy mortgage securities. Okay.
And they're reporting huge profits now, and that's the result of?
That's the result of continued derivative trading that is now financed with government-guaranteed debt because we allowed them to become a holding company that could issue FDIC-insured debt. So they're now essentially able to trade derivatives with our credit.
And why are derivatives so devastating, and have they played such a terrible role in the meltdown?
Because they are very powerful leverage. So if I take an economic activity that has a cash flow of $1,000 and I can issue debt on it and I can issue derivatives on top of it, particularly if they're fraudulently created, then I can find a way out of this activity that generates $1,000 to create millions. Okay? And now, let's say we were in a free market society. If all that stuff was sort of phony baloney financial engineering, it would just crash and fail, and they would go under and the stuff would be stopped. Now, what happened was they issued a lot of this stuff, you know, either because the mortgages were rotten and they knew it, or because the securities were fraudulent and they knew it, and the derivatives were over-leveraged and rotten and they knew it. But what happened is we came along and gave trillion-dollar bailouts to refinance out all the fraudulent paper. So think of it this way. Let's say I have a company and I'm making orange juice, and you, Dennis, are a predator, and you want to take over my orange juice company, so you go out and issue a lot of fraudulent paper to raise $1 million to take over my company. You use the $1 million to take over the company, and then when your first million fails, you know, your fraudulent securities, you then take the capital from my company to pay off the $1 million. So think of, if we think of this as a financial coup d'etat, what we need to realize is phony paper was issued to finance the coup d'etat, and then essentially enough political clout had been acquired so that the country basically paid off the phony paper from the money, you know, from the government budget and Federal Reserve and Treasury loans.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, and our technical director is Eric Klein. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera, Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.